Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
And guess what the number of the week is, Tracy? Oh, wait. We should give it to our special guest.
We're going to give it to our special guest. We have to introduce our special guest.
Calling in from the airport because he's traveling all over the country for Social Security's birthday, Alex Lawson. Thank you for calling in literally from the airport.
Thanks for having me, and I apologize for the background noise.
So I think Rebecca might have already given you a clue in the intro, but this week's number of the week is 80.
Wait, I can guess it. It's 80.
Yeah. Can you take a wild guess as why that's the number of the week?
It's 80 because that's the number of years that Social Security has been around. For 80 years, through boom time and bust, through war and peace, Social Security has never missed a single payment. So what I am is I have actually a somewhat of a small audience here who are just wondering what I am doing in the corner at the airport singing happy birthday to Social Security into my phone.
And you should tell them the answer is you are on everyone's favorite radio show about poverty because this is a huge birthday and this was so important you had to call in from the airport terminal.
Yes, that is what I'm implying that. With my body language.
So we alluded to the fact that you've been on the road for a bit. Can you tell us how you've been celebrating this milestone?
So working with our partners and allies, the Alliance for Retired Americans, the People Demanding Action, Center for Community Progress, and others, Center for Community Change and others, we have had over 160 birthday parties for both Social Security, which turned 80 this year, and Medicare, which turned 50 this year, all across the country. And I just came from Denver to Nevada to Ohio, now back to D.C. And in all of these cases, what we were doing, first of all, we had cake. Second of all, we sung happy birthday to Social Security. But third of all, we were saying that this program is so important to America. This program is so loved by all Americans that there's absolutely no way that we're going to let this program be cut. And in fact, now is the time we have to expand it.
So it sounds like the cake, maybe not even the highlight, right? Because when you've got Social Security expansion in the conversation, it's sort of hard to top that.
You would think that, but actually the cake is always the most popular part of the day.
All right, I stand corrected. Cake pulls even better than expanding Social Security. You heard it here first on Talk Poverty Radio. So, Alex, what are you going to be doing when you get back to D.C. and sort of gear up for Congress coming back?
Well, one of the birthday parties that we went to out in California with Representative Javier Becerra, with Leader Nancy Pelosi, and a host of other Democratic leadership, was actually to celebrate Social Security's birthday and to set a marker about a bill that Representative Becerra has introduced called the One Social Security Act. And this bill would combine the trust funds of the old age retirement and the DI trust fund. So I don't want to get too wonky because your audience are already very knowledgeable about this, but they're two trust funds that function as one, and this bill would just make them actually one. What that is doing is going on offense against the Republicans' attempt to divide and conquer and to split Social Security, pitting one part of Social Security against another part, not understanding that, in fact, there is only one Social Security. And I'm very confident that with leadership like Representative Becerra is showing, with support from Leader Pelosi, with the incredible amount of support from the American people, that we're going to be able to advance this goal and defeat the attempt to split Social Security and divide and conquer. And in fact, we'll gain some momentum on our drive to expand Social Security.
Your organization's doing a lot of work, obviously, around this. Where can our listeners find more information about this legislation and other work as it relates to Social Security?
Always at our website at socialsecurityworks.org.
Really hiding the ball there with how you guys feel about Social Security, Alex.
And I have to add, just the kind words that you were saying about Social Security was making me think, wow, if he says this kind of stuff to his wife, she's a lucky woman. It was like you had opened with a love letter.
I feel like there's no way the stuff he says to his wife is nearly as nice as what he says about Social Security. She doesn't listen to this, does she, Alex?
Oh, of course she does. The nation's favorite radio show about poverty. Layla loves your show.
All right. Well, hopefully you can.
You're not going to get me in trouble though, because I also am going to bring her a cake too.
So. Can celebrate together.
Hopefully you don't put 80 candles on that one yet, though. We've got a great episode lined up, Tracy. We've got Michael Hiltzik. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist at the LA Times and, in my opinion, the best columnist on Social Security anywhere in the country.
We also have Kevin Prindeville, who's the Executive Director for Justice and Aging, and he's going to discuss why senior poverty isn't over.
And finally, we'll have Mike Konzel. He is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and also a contributor to The Nation magazine and Dissent Mag, better known as @RortyBaum.
So thank you so much for joining us, Alex. As always, we'll have to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. And obviously, I'd come back anytime you ask, even if I'm just standing in the corner at the airport like I'm doing right now.
We appreciate your dedication. I have to say, there are no friends of the show who are more reliably able to call in rain, shine, and plane problems than you.
Thanks, all.
Thanks.
This is Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross.
Our guest is Michael Hiltzik. He is a columnist with the LA Times. Michael, thank you so much for joining the show.
It's my pleasure to be here with you.
So we're excited to have you on for Social Security's 80th birthday, or it's not the actual day anymore, but close enough. And we wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that rather than being 100% celebratory, much, if not most, of the media coverage commemorating Social Security's 80th birthday focused on the fact that the Social Security trust funds are projected to deplete their reserves, usually called becoming insolvent, in 2034. And when you read news articles about this, you would think that the sky was falling. But you don't see it that way. Why not?
No, I don't see it that way. And what I do see is that there's been this concerted campaign to paint Social Security as somehow as fiscally impaired, especially in the short term, which, as we all know, is completely untrue. We know that the Disability Trust Fund is facing exhaustion in a little bit more than a year. But leaving that aside, the overall fiscal status of Social Security is pretty healthy. I mean, when you talk about the trust fund being depleted in 2034, actually 2035, if you just look at the old age program itself, that's 20 years from now. And I've maintained, and I think many others have pointed out over the years, that that's a long period of time. Nobody, no corporation, no government agency really looks ahead 20 years at what's going to be the condition two decades hence, because you can never know. And if you make decisions today based on that sort of timeline or time span, then you really risk making the wrong decision and making a decision that's irrevocable in the case of Social Security. So it's very unwise. I mean, you will hear critics of Social Security say, we have to do something now because if we wait, then it's only going to be tougher. But there's a long time to wait. And the argument that we should cut benefits now because we may have to cut them in 20 years, to me, has never made much rational sense.
So you're saying that in the short term, it's relatively solvent. We don't have too much to be worried about for at least 20 years. But Rebecca and I, we're both millennials, and we're mature for our age. But I remember reading somewhere that more people, I think, in our age bracket, believe in UFOs than actually believe that they will be able to receive Social Security benefits.
Well, Yeah, I mean, this is something, this is a trope or a meme that I've addressed many times in the past. I mean, first of all, when you ask people who are millennials today, or, you know, anybody over the years who's been the age of millennials today, and this goes back to the 1940s, really, all of the opinion polls that have been done about this sort of thing for decades and decades and decades shows the same thing. And that is, nobody who's in their 20s today, if you say, how confident are you in a program that's going to deliver something to you in 40 years, nobody is going to say, I'm perfectly confident. It's always, you always see this sort of skepticism, and it's a natural skepticism about what the future holds. So polls like this were done in the 40s, they were done in the 50s, and 20-year-old people were asked, how confident are you in Social Security? And they always got the same result, which is, I'm really not sure. I don't have any reason to be confident or not confident. And in fact, you know, I think you're probably familiar with the Leninist approach to undermining Social Security, which was something that was ginned up by a couple of Heritage and Cato types 20 or 30 years ago, in which they said the way to destroy public confidence in Social Security is to divide and conquer. Older people are going to be confident in Social Security because they can see it happening. So forget about them. But if you go to the younger generations and say, this may not be here for you, then you really have a wedge to attack. And that, you know, that old UFO thing, you know, that was one poll that was done, and, you know, it was basically fanciful. And, you know, do you believe in UFOs? Yeah, sure. You know, of course, who doesn't? You know, do you believe in Social Security? Well, gee, I don't know. And you know, when you ask people to compare something that's fantasy to something that may or may not be reality, you're going to get these odd, you know, these odd results. But it doesn't really tell you that people, you know, believe they're going to be abducted by aliens more than they're going to get their Social Security benefits at age 65 or 6 or 7.
When you got to take into account that we're also talking about the generation that grew up with the X-Files, right?
Well, sure.
Well, hopefully, hey, look, you just restored some confidence.
I was a science fiction fan when I was in my teens and 20s, you know, a devoted fan. And to me, you know, when you talk about movies, there's 2001 and there's everything else.
You know? There you go.
But I still believe in Social Security.
So you mentioned divide and conquer as sort of an age-old strategy that's been deployed time and again to try to undermine confidence in Social Security. And I feel like you can't talk about divide and conquer right now without talking about Social Security disability insurance.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good point. And this is, to me, you know, you see cynical approaches to programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid all over, and Obamacare all over the political landscape. And we're all probably in agreement that this is really a disturbing development in our political discourse. The Disability Trust Fund is facing exhaustion by the fourth quarter of 2016, but that's an artifact of a number of things that I think we have in hand. One is that since the recession, and maybe even a little longer, there's been a long tail affecting the disability insurance program. You know, it involves the aging of the population, the economic downturn in 2008, the entry of more women into the workforce, changes in the rules that made it much more, that made people with non-musculoskeletal ailments, including, you know, mood problems and mental problems, to apply and receive disability. These all made disability much more important to millions of people. But as the Social Security's own actuary has pointed out, we have crested on all of those elements. And the likelihood is that the caseload of disability, you know, has peaked and is already beginning to come down. There were changes in disability's funding that led predictably to this this event. But everybody knows, including officials at Social Security, and I think even enemies of Social Security who know their stuff, that all that's really required is to reallocate some of the payroll tax to the Disability Trust Fund. You can do it. You can add 20 years to at least to the life of the Disability Trust Fund without impairing the Old Age Trust Fund in any significant way. And that's clearly the way to go, rather than some of these draconian ideas that we hear from certain politicians, and certain ideological groups about, cutting benefits or reducing eligibility or all these things that really would work to the detriment of the disabled community.
So are the attacks that we have seen on Social Security disability insurance an attempt at dividing and conquering seniors and pitting them against people with disabilities?
Yes, and I think that's just one of so many different attack points that the enemies of Social Security have. I mean, we've talked about pitting young against old, and there's this whole notion out there that that the older generations are ripping off the younger generations, and that's just, the numbers say that's just pure nonsense. Then there's the retiree population pitting them against the disabled population, and we all know how the disabled population has been utterly demonized by political ideologues and by sort of soft-minded journalists. And I hate to criticize my own profession, but nobody knows the drawbacks of a journalistic effort more than journalists. We know the techniques and we see the flaws, and those of us who really have studied disability and Social Security just know where the misinformation lies and how it's pervaded. So this is all wrapped together, and yes, this is all an attempt to reduce the support of Social Security in general by the general public. And, they'll pit rich against poor, they'll pit the middle class against the working class, they'll do anything they can to try to make it seem as though this is something other than what it is, which is a universal program that's helped. Right now, there's 59 million beneficiaries in the United States and millions of people over the decades who've been kept out of poverty.
Speaking of attacks on the program, something that's been interesting to witness is that throughout the 2016 campaigns that are already gearing up and underway, many candidates have come out to say that they won't cut Social Security. Do you think this is a reflection of the popularity of the program, or what do you think is at play here?
Yeah, I think that a smart politician on any side of the ideological or political divide knows, because the evidence is so strong, that you can walk up to the edge, but there's a point at which you cannot cross in attacking Social Security. It's an enormously popular program, and it's not just the elderly who benefit, but it's families, whose breadwinners have become disabled or died, an untimely death, who've been able to stay in school because of Social Security. I think Social Security doesn't do enough to make sure that more Americans understand all of the elements of the benefits of Social Security. But I think it really is broadly popular, and I think people want it to be strong and stronger, but they don't want that to be done at the expense of what it actually achieves, which is to keep people out of poverty and in the economy when they get, when they get disabled or are left without family support or grow old. And that's been the principle almost since the very beginning. And people still feel that. I mean, this is a program that is deeply ingrained into the American psyche.
Well, and one of the policies that polls exceptionally well is, and that's actually the case even across party lines, is raising or even outright eliminating the payroll tax cap. And several bills introduced by congressional Democrats in the last couple of years include various approaches to doing that. Currently, a worker only pays payroll taxes on the first $118,500 of their wages. So someone who has wages of $1 million stops paying in early February compared to a worker who makes less than $1 million who pays in all year around. Now, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman has theorized, as recently as in a column earlier this week, that the reason that we don't see congressional Republicans supporting raising or scrapping the payroll tax cap, despite the fact that it's supported even by conservative voters, is that because Social Security is incredibly popular with the American public overall, but that the group that doesn't care as much about it is the super, super wealthy. Do you agree?
Well, I do agree. I mean, we've certainly seen, the super wealthy who've been campaigning against Social Security often use themselves as an example. You know, Pete Peterson will say, why should somebody like me, get Social Security? That's insane. And of course, we all know that people like Pete Peterson are a tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of Social Security beneficiaries, and that if you were going to do what he suggests, which is say to means test it or means test it more, then you'd have to dip down into people who are earning $30,000 or $40,000 in retirement for it really to make a difference. I think to a billionaire or even a multi-millionaire, the amount that they get from Social Security is going to be modest and maybe almost invisible. And of course, as a replacement rate of their pre-retirement income, it's minuscule. I think there's something to what Paul says, but there's another element to this that I think people don't normally appreciate, and that is that the Social Security tax, even if you were to raise or eliminate the cap, nobody talks about extending it to unearned income like capital gains or dividends and interest, because that's exempt from Social Security tax in all cases for all strata of the income ladder. And of course, if you were going to add, say, capital gains to the, make that subject to payroll tax, that would really hurt the super rich because they get most of their income from that category. And I think certainly in the back of their minds and maybe in the forefront, they're thinking about, what would happen if they not only raised the cap but extended the tax to cover all income. That would really hurt. And the super rich, will move heaven and earth to protect their capital gains preference. So they don't want to do that. But, that all being said, I think it's important for people to recognize that the cap on 118.5, what makes it particularly unfair is that, first of all, it really just covers the middle class and it leaves higher income people, relatively untrusted, a very regressive cap, but also nobody pays tax on unearned income. And that's a huge boon to the upper 10%, 5%, 1%, 0.1%, that we don't appreciate. And that if we remove the cap on earned income, but left it on unearned income, then the tax would be much fairer. It still wouldn't cover everything, but it would really do so much to improve Social Security that obviously it's the way to go. And the idea that people in the presidential campaign are finally beginning to talk more about increasing revenue and not just about cutting benefits is, certainly a great advance in the discussion.
Well, and we've really seen the Social Security expansion movement take off in the past couple of years. I mean, it's gone from something that was seen as a fringe idea to something that even the capital V, capital S, capital P, very serious people actually talk about and even support.
And that's very important. And that's sort of an artifact also of the growing concern about income inequality. One of the elements of income inequality is that the middle class and the working class's retirement options have really shrunk over the years. When I retire, I'm going to get a defined benefit plan because I happen to have worked for the same company for decades and decades. But I sometimes I feel like I'm the last worker standing who's going to get a defined benefit pension. And that used to be much more of the norm. Instead, we've moved to defined contribution plans like 401ks, which are really vulnerable to economic and market conditions and really shift the risk of planning for people's retirements from their employers onto themselves. And it's a risk that many people can't manage and can't afford. And then, of course, we, you know, the other foot of the retirement stool is people's personal resources, and we know what the market has done to those. You know, a series of downturns in the stock market has really eviscerated a lot of people's nest eggs. And the one element of the retirement stool that has remained steadfast and strong is Social Security. And we can see when we look at the percentage or the proportion of people's retirements that come from Social Security and pensions and personal resources, Social Security is much, much, much more important to people in the working class than to anyone else. And that's because despite all these huge market downturns, Social Security hasn't been affected by them. So it's more important than ever before. And its importance really tells you that we can only be helped by it becoming more important, by expanding it, by bringing young people up to college age back into the beneficiary class, that is those who whose family breadwinners have passed away. They used to be able to get dependent payments through well into college. Now it ends at the end of high school. Many politicians, and I won't name any by name, who've been campaigning against Social Security were beneficiaries of that program, and they've more or less pulled the ladder up behind them. And this is a class of beneficiaries who I think, you know, we pay lip service to, you know, our youth who are in college, and we need to help them. And of course, we need to increase benefits because they have become so important.
And something that you wrote about recently, actually, is how the Social Security Administration plays into this, and the fact that over the past few years, they've been deprived of the money that they need to actually operate. And then this has real consequences. You know, there's been fiscal shortfalls to the tune of about $1 billion. Could you explain why this is a critical component of ensuring that Social Security works?
Well, what I've talked about is how if you really want to destroy the credibility of a business or a program, then cut into its customer service, and it will lose support very, very quickly. And there's been a long pattern now of, first of all, of White House administrations not asking for enough for Social Security's administrative needs, and then Congress cutting it even further in the name of smaller government, except, of course, all the administrative costs for Social Security come from the payroll tax or other revenues. And we have seen, we've seen a sharp reduction in field offices. We've seen a reduction in the hours that the remaining field offices remain open. We've seen longer wait times on Social Security's 800 number and more busy signals. We've seen the elimination for most contributors to Social Security, most Americans, that is, of the annual paper-mailed Social Security statement, which was a critical way that Social Security maintained the support of its members by reminding them of how much they had put in and how much they were due and what the benefits were. And that was cut, to save a few dollars. $70 million, which is, a rounding error on Social Security's budget. So this is all really disturbing. And we've
also seen the backlog for disability hearings rise to more than 1 million people waiting for the benefits they earned.
Well, that's true. And the same critics and politicians who talk about, the backlog for disability being too long and the disability approval process being too inefficient, well, they're the ones who are trying to cut the budget.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, columnist with the LA Times, thank you so much for coming on Talk Poverty Radio. We will look forward to having you back for Social Security's 100th birthday.
Well, I hope I'll be collecting Social
Security. You will? Perfect.
Thank you so much.
But I'll be doing it with great, you know, great gratitude.
There you go.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and with me is Kevin Prindeville. He is the executive director of Justice in Aging, formerly known as the National Senior Citizens Law Center. Welcome, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Rebecca.
Well, and I have to say, I feel like with the name change, you guys should wear capes. Do you have capes?
We don't have capes. We have some handbags. That's as close as we've gotten.
You didn't bring me a handbag?
Not yet.
Okay, so Kevin, I wanna have sort of a difficult conversation with you because I feel like a lot of the media coverage commemorating Social Security's 80th birthday has basically focused on how today the senior poverty rate is about 10%, but without Social Security, that it would be more like 43% or even a little bit higher. And other big anniversaries that we celebrated this year are Medicaid, Medicare, which have also done a lot to reduce senior poverty and hardship. So it seems like seniors are kind of doing fine, right? Like, why does Justice in Aging even still exist? Why haven't you guys closed up shop?
Yeah, well, that's a great question and one that we do often get, because there is this perception that because we've got programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid that have just been so tremendously successful. I mean, Social Security alone, you know, we've been celebrating the 80th anniversary the last couple of weeks. Social Security alone has kept 21 million people out of poverty every year. About 15 million seniors are kept out of poverty every year by that program. So we've got these successful programs. But the impact and the ability of those programs to keep seniors out of poverty over time, unfortunately, has decreased. And so what we see is that even though those programs work well, they've not been a cure. And so we still have about 6.3 million seniors living in poverty. That's using the supplemental poverty measure, which is a more accurate measure of senior poverty. So about 15% of seniors are actually living in poverty when you take into account their healthcare costs.
And the supplemental poverty measure that's the measure which, unlike the official poverty measure, not only takes into account assistance programs that help people like Social Security, but also costs?
That's right. They take into costs. And for seniors, that makes a tremendous difference. So what the supplemental poverty measure does that the official poverty measure doesn't is take into account healthcare costs. And for seniors, annual healthcare costs can add up to thousands of dollars a year. You know, Medicare is a wonderful program, but it does include significant cost sharing for individuals enrolled in the program. So when you take in those costs, there's many more seniors living in poverty and then also living in a range that we call economically vulnerable. So almost half of our country's seniors are economically vulnerable, meaning they live with incomes less than 200% of the federal poverty level.
Okay, so you've persuaded me that you guys should still exist. Justice in Aging has important work to do. Senior poverty, still a thing. But why? I mean, can you maybe break down a little bit why senior poverty is still an important issue that we really need to still focus on?
Yeah, well, we think, unfortunately, it's going to become an even bigger issue that's going to need even more attention. And we're looking at four factors that contribute to that. The first is demographic. The second is changes in the economy that have made it difficult for people to save. The third is rising costs of growing old. And then the fourth is the decreasing impact of the social safety net. So the first one, the demographics, are things that you know people are starting to hear about. But every time I hear the numbers and look at the numbers and write about the numbers, I still can't believe it, right? 10,000 people turn 65 every day in America. That's an astounding number. Between 2000 and 2030, the number of older adults is going to double to over 72 million older adults. So huge numbers of people growing older, even if the current poverty rate among seniors stays the same, we're going to see a massive increase in just the pure numbers of older adults living in poverty. And you can already start to see this. I mean, if you walk down the street in Washington, D.C., which has the highest rate of poverty among seniors in the country, 1 in 4 seniors in D.C. Is living in poverty.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's shocking. But you don't see it when you walk down in downtown D.C. very much, except in the homeless people. If you look at homeless people, you'll notice that most homeless people that you pass are older individuals. If they're not 65, they're 55 and older. So the demographic change is going to be a huge driver in more seniors just unable to make ends meet, having to make decisions between rent and prescriptions and food, decisions nobody should have to make. So that's one. The second factor are these changes in our economy. And there's a lot of talk about how much our economy has changed over the last several decades, but not enough attention paid to how that impacts people as they retire. So we've seen stagnant wages. We've seen the loss of pension plans. We've seen, for women, decades and decades of unequal pay. And all of these differences are making it harder for people to save, harder for people to be prepared as they retire. And the impact, just as we talk about for the working age population, the impact of these changes are even stronger for women and for people of color. So they're the ones that are at the most risk of being insecure when they retire. The third factor that we talk about is how it's getting more expensive to grow older. You know, so we talked about healthcare costs already and how significant they are for older adults. More older adults are living with mortgages, with as renters, so they have more housing costs when they grow older than they did before. The cost of long-term care is increasing, and more individuals need long-term care services as they age. So it's just getting more expensive to be old, which forces more seniors into insecure retirement. And then that fifth or the fourth element is the fact that programs as successful as they are, like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the value of those programs, SSI is another big one, the value of those programs isn't going as far as it used to.
And we'll come back to the safety net and to SSI in particular, but something that you've written about that maybe isn't readily obvious is the impact of the housing crisis on senior poverty and what that means moving forward. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's these longstanding changes in our economy over the last several decades, rising inequality, stagnant wages. But then there's also the recent economic recession that was really driven by the housing crisis. And that's impacted in particular this group of individuals that are just now becoming what we define as older adults. So these are people that had a lot of equity tied up in their home and then lost that equity in the recession. So now the main nest egg, the main place where they were saving money, was washed away during the housing crisis. They also, to compound that, they're also the group of people that were most likely to be laid off in the recession, that group between 50 and 64, most likely to be laid off, least likely to get rehired. If they had a 401k, if they were lucky enough to have a 401k, they likely depleted some of that 401k to pay the mortgage on the house that was underwater in the years that they weren't working. So it's this compounding effect of multiple decades of changes in our economy that left people worse off. And then particularly in the recession, things that left this group just as they're about to retire in a really insecure position.
And you mentioned the decline in defined benefit pensions provided by employers. But, a phrase that we often hear is the retirement savings crisis. Is that overblown or is that really a thing?
No, I mean, that's really absolutely a thing. That if you look at the numbers, a shockingly low number of people over 50 have savings over $10,000. So it's shocking. And the problem, I think the solutions there maybe are a little bit overblown. What we see is that, as someone said to me once, you can't save your way out of poverty. If you're not making enough to cover your mortgage, to pay for food, to get your kids to school, to save for their college in your working years, how can you find the money that you need now to prepare for retirement that's going to cost you more than it ever did in the past?
So if cutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and other vital programs for seniors is the wrong direction, what is the policy agenda we need to be focused on to address and be prepared for and really even stave off this coming senior poverty crisis that you've talked about?
I think there's two big things that need to happen and that we talk a lot about at Justice and Aging. And one of them is on the policy side. But even before then, we've really been working to raise the profile of this issue, because just like we started today, a lot of people don't even know that over 6 million seniors are living below the poverty line. And to talk about the issue, to raise the profile of those seniors and their needs and just what it means to be a poor senior, that you're choosing between, am I going to cut my medications in half? Am I going to only have a half a can of beans tonight so that I can have the other half tomorrow? Really difficult decision. So really, you know, calling that out and talking to people about that. And then creating connections between the experiences of seniors as they age and other progressive movements, right? The other movements to challenge economic inequality for working age folks, for children, you know, building those bridges. Because if we don't get a living wage for folks while they're working, then what's it going to look like when they retire and they didn't have enough money to save and weren't able to prepare for retirement? So I think first, just on the progressive movement, we've got to connect these dots. The aging community, the progressive aging community, needs to be joining the cause for younger folks in their fight for economic equality. And the non-aging community that's fighting racial equality and economic equality also has to include the aging community and think about how policies they're fighting for now can really improve the lives of their communities as they age. So that's, I think, the first step. And then the second step is on the policy side. And, you know, on the policy side, we've got to defend those programs. You know, there's no fooling around there. You know, we got to defend Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. The Older Americans Act is a program that's been under threat for a long time. And then we've got to think proactively and aggressively about what really needs to happen. So just defending those programs, keeping them flat, is not going to help us as the number of poor seniors rises. What we've got to do is actively improve those programs. So expanding Social Security. You know, and this is a issue that, thank God, is getting attention on the presidential campaign, especially for those individuals that are the lowest wage workers, that are the lowest income seniors, doing things to improve the benefit for women, because we know that they're not getting the full benefit relative to men. And therefore, there's twice as many women living in poverty as men. So we've got to expand Social Security, really strengthen that benefit and expand it. We've got to restore SSI, so the Supplemental Security Income Program.
Tell us a little bit about what SSI is before you even talk about why we need to restore it. This is sort of the stepchild program. It gets way less attention and appreciation than Social Security. What is SSI?
Right. So the Supplemental Security Income Program is a program available to seniors and people with disabilities whose incomes are so low that they don't qualify for Social Security. They only qualify for a small Social Security benefit. So to qualify for the program, they have to have income of less than $733 a month and assets of less than $10,000 or $2,000.
And to put that in, well, you want it to be $10,000. Yes. We're going to get there. You know where you're going. Freudian slip there, Kevin. To put $733 in context, right, that's like 3/4 of the federal poverty level for an individual. That's really poor.
That's right, right. It's exactly 75% of the federal poverty level. So, and even those that qualify for the benefit, all the benefit does is bring their income up to the SSI level. So we've told this group of seniors and people with disabilities, we'll help you, but we're still going to leave you at 75% of the federal poverty level.
So why does the program need to be restored, as you put it? And I feel like we've presaged it a little bit by mentioning that you want to raise the asset limit. What do we need to do to restore this program?
Right. Well, so and you said, you know, this is a stepchild program. It's been around since 1972. It was intended to be a program that would lift seniors out of poverty. Instead, it's left them trapped in poverty.
Signed into law by President Nixon.
By President Nixon, right. My how things have changed, right? And it's a program that hasn't gotten attention since then. You know, the asset limit, which is $2,000 now, has moved once in the 40-plus years that the program has been around. The income level is adjusted, but the formula for adjusting that level has not changed for a very long time. So we've been working with many partners on a bill called the SSI Restoration Act. It's sponsored in the Senate now by Senators Brown and Warren and Sanders and actually many others now and many in the House. And it would change the asset limit, increase the asset limit. It would get rid of some arcane eligibility rules that penalize people for their poverty. So, you know, those things would help us create a more robust safety net for really the poorest seniors that are out there.
So last question is maybe going to be my hardest one. So get ready. So a common refrain that we hear when people are talking about sort of the federal budget debate and how do we want to be spending our federal resources is that we're already doing plenty to help seniors, right? But what we're not doing is enough to help or invest in kids. What do you say when you hear that kind of argument?
Well, first of all, a lot of those arguments are used as setups to then say why we should cut the program, but only for people that are under 50 years old. So there's this really odd argument, right, that we're doing too much for people that are 50 and over today, but so we're going to cut programs for people that are under 50. So it's a strange argument, and we think it's a false argument, right? I mean, we have to get out of a mentality that there's only a limited amount of things that we can do for people that really need our help in this country. I think economic inequality is a problem that stretches across age groups, kids, working people, older adults. And we need to come up with solutions that decrease economic inequality across all age groups. And so it's not a matter of only helping kids or only helping seniors. It's finding ways to help all populations and realizing that that there are cross-generational impacts of everything that we do, that seniors are an important part of the lives of our children. We certainly realize that children are an important part of the community that seniors want to be a part of and connected to in their families and communities. And by working together to improve the lives of all folks that have been disadvantaged by current economic structures, will be better.
Kevin Prindeville, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio. Where can our listeners find out more about what Justice and Aging is working on?
At our website, justiceandaging.org. We have a blog and lots of information there. And then also we're on Twitter and Facebook and all the rest.
And you'll have capes soon?
Yes, capes will be ordered soon. And we'll be sure you get one and the whole team here at Talk
Poverty. I want the first cape.
Any color requests?
Probably pink.
All right, you got it.
All right, thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
This is Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we're joined by a very special guest today.
Mike Konzel. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's also a contributor to The Nation magazine and Dissent. Thanks so much for joining us, Mike.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So you have written about what you call the voluntarism fantasy. It's basically that conservatives dream of returning to a world where private charity fulfilled all public needs. Those are your words. But you say that world never existed and we're better for it. Tell us what you mean by that.
Sure. So one thing I've noticed a lot lately, and over the past couple of years, but particularly over the past couple decades when I started to dig into it, was the notion that if we got rid of a lot of social insurance programs, this is income support, this is Social Security, this is food stamps, that people would not be worse off because private forms of income support, charity, volunteerism societies, would largely go in and fill those out. And in fact, these government programs were a net negative for society because they crowded out these efforts by civil society, by communities, to deal with poverty and deal with real income insecurity. And I heard that and it sounded like a wrong idea. And I really wanted to dig into the history of it and really kind of come up with a deep argument for why it's a wrong idea. And that's what I did in this piece for Democracy Journal a few years ago. And I think it's really comes up again and again. And I think we're going to hear it a lot more as we talk about Social Security and as we talk about the 2016 election.
So tell us more about why this world never existed. Give us a little bit of a history lesson.
Sure. So like a lot of conservative thinking, it involves going back to a 19th century that never really existed. This idea that somehow before the New Deal, now with all this Glenn Beck stuff, before the Progressive Era, there was just like not a state and everything was done privately by individuals or by communities. And it was much better, or at least it was no worse off. And first of all, that's just not true. If you go back to the 19th century, there's poorhouses. There's a lot of state interventions and fighting and debate about what to do with the problem of people who are chronically poor, problems of people who are disabled, problems of people who have poverty in old age, problems of people who are sick. These are are often called the four horsemen of like kind of income security: sickness, disability, unemployment, and poor health. And so there's always been government interventions to try to deal with this problem, often in an ad hoc and piecemeal way. Things from bankruptcy laws to Civil War pensions, to the poorhouse, which I mentioned earlier, were all these kinds of ad hoc things. And what a lot of people often point to is these voluntarism societies that sprouted up, particularly in the 1920s, particularly in immigrant communities. And that whole system, which was nowhere near as secure, nowhere near as deep as a lot of conservatives imagine, all of these ways of thinking of things were just wiped out by the Great Depression. And in its wake came Social Security, which really did eliminate, certainly by the 1960s when it was formalized, really did eliminate poverty among old age. And there's deep reasons to understand why the government has this role, reasons why private, individual, and market-based systems just won't work over the long haul.
So let's fast forward then a bit to present day. You know, if I'm just an average citizen, the idea that a charity can step in and really do good, it seems, you know, pretty practical to me. You know, I remember talking to, I'll explain this to you later, Rebecca, but talking to a conservative in Florida, and they're like, even the poorest person in the U.S. can go to a soup kitchen. We have the poorest people in the world. So there's almost this idea that, you know, it makes more practical sense to have charities do this. You know, how would you respond to that?
Sure. So there's a couple really specific reasons why this won't work. One is just the business cycle. We saw in the Great Recession, when the Great Recession really came on in 2008 and 2009, when unemployment hit 10%, charitable giving fell. And it fell as a percentage of GDP. It fell in raw numbers. And it fell specifically when people were asked about it. People just said they were insecure. They don't have money. They, you know, they're worried. So there's a business cycle reason that the government can step in when the economy is collapsing and provide broad income support. That's the idea of unemployment insurance, the increase in food stamps that went with a higher rate of unemployment. The second is, you know, regional issues. There are areas that, you know, can be rich or poor in times. We saw it in the Great Recession with a lot of areas got really hit by the housing bust, and places that were hit by the housing bust, places like Arizona, California, Florida, Nevada, were much worse off. But places that weren't as hit, you know, basically you could transfer resources across them. And it works really well in the United States. If you're just dealing locally, you know, places that are hit the hardest are not going to be able to step up and provide need the way that they can. And the third is that, you know, a lot of charity is essentially a lot of, you know, rich people signaling. We see it with all these donations that go to Harvard or Yale, and you think, is this really the best use of money for these colleges that are kind of like giant hedge funds already? Do they really need hundreds of millions of dollars more when people are starving? There are things that, if it is a societal need, the government can provide the baseline and also set the baseline. And then once that baseline is set, private charity can come in and be much more nimble. You know, the four things we identified earlier, disability, illness, unemployment, and old age, are just, they're heavy lifts. And they're deep and persistent heavy lifts. And it's very difficult for any individual to tackle them by themselves, or any community of individuals to tackle them by themselves, which is why the governments across the Western nations play a role in this.
So no longer playing a devil's advocate, why do you think that this, I guess, romanticization, is that even a word? This of I'll go with it. Why do you think that this story continues to play out, that this idea that charity can fill in, if, you know, you're laid out the facts so easily?
Well, it's, you know, it's obviously, it would be a better world, I suppose. You know, the idea that we can, you know, simply just take care of ourselves in small communities. You know, I don't know that, you know, I don't think that ever really happened, but it certainly doesn't happen out here in the 21st century, where, you know, the market in the world is just radically different than it's been in the past. There's a great House hearing about a year ago or half a year ago where they had leaders of various food bank organizations come before the House. And I think the Republicans were excited to hear them talk about, like, oh, we can tackle poverty. We don't need food stamps. And instead, what they all said basically to a T is the sequestration and the government cuts that have come since 2010 have put them hugely at risk. Because a lot of states also are cutting back on their income support budgets, which basically means that they have to pick up more, but there's no more donations, there's no more volunteering than there was before. And it shows that, and I think this is a really important point, is that our third sector, our civil society's always been joined at the hip with the government. There's always been a back and forth in how those things are done. And things like food stamps and things like donations to food banks, which is in the federal budget, really do help secure out, which is then supplemented and made much more rich and locally vigorous by individual charity and individual action among communities.
So then what's the motivation, cynically? I'm going to ask you a cynical question here. What's the motivation behind perpetuating this volunteerism fantasy?
You know, there's these, you know, cake and eat it too arguments, right? So, you know, a lot of conservatives will make arguments that say, you know, if you cut taxes, we can raise revenue because we'll just grow that much faster. That doesn't happen. You know, there's a big argument in the recession saying if there was austerity, it would be expansionary. Like, you would actually, the economy would take off if we just did austerity, which didn't happen. And I think there's this idea that, you know, if we cut income support or we just cut our ability to provide social insurance for people, all this private energy would just be unleashed. And it's a, you know, it's a nice thought that, you know, you can have your cake and eat it too, right? That, like, you know, it would be painless to do these things. But there's reasons both historically and in practice why it doesn't happen that way and why we do, in fact, see things like Social Security radically reduce elderly poverty, poverty among, especially among women and children, and why cuts to those things would disproportionately increase poverty.
And we've been talking about this in relation to what conservatives are saying. And so you've argued that progressives need our own definition of charity. And you cited President Truman giving a speech at the United Way when he said, "I like the campaign slogan this year. Everybody gives, everybody benefits. It marks a significant change in our thinking about the word charity." Is this a progressive definition to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really useful definition to like start with, to say that there is charity. And, you know, it's, civil society is incredibly important to liberals and progressives. The ability of communities to come together in associations, including unions and including churches and other groups. But we have to understand their limitations. To respect something is to understand what it can't do. And the idea that groups like that can just simply solve the problem of poverty in old age is just not possible. It's not possible among families, and it's not possible among other groups. And to try to do that would fundamentally weaken the ability of those groups to function in the ways that they need to, which are broader and more social.
So do you think we can apply that definition then to social insurance?
Absolutely. I think a really important thing, one thing I didn't understand until I had to start dealing with movement conservatives as opposed to just general people who happen to be conservatives, you know, because I'm relatively new to this world of politics. I've been in this for about 4 or 5 years, is that when you talk to people who are really conservative, in the movement sense, and as they work for think tanks or they work for institutions, they don't want to fix Social Security, and they don't even really want to cut it. I mean, they would like to cut it perhaps, but what they really want to do is privatize it. Which is why you often find a lot of them just aren't that interested in trying to fix balances or think of innovative ways to try to make the social insurance programs work better, because they don't want them to work at all. And they, one of the important rhetorical tools that they're going to use, the idea that families and churches and communities would be better off if these programs were gone, that is simply not the case. Those institutions would be much weaker because they have to carry a weight that they've never been able to historically.
Which takes us back to something we heard about earlier in the episode from Michael Hiltzik at the LA Times, talking about how one of the shrewdest moves that conservatives have made in the last several years is to defund Social Security's administrative budget so that it can effectively have poorer customer service and therefore less in the way of public support. But our last question for you is, and this is sort of a big picture one to close it out, you've written that the need for social insurance is actually really what gave birth to the progressive movement. How did that happen?
Sure. So, you know, starting in the late 19th century, I mean, you suddenly had huge problems with illness, unemployment, disability, and old age, and poverty and old age, things that could be handled here and there, but suddenly became incredibly more chronic with, you know, the advance of large-scale industrialization, move away from a farm-based economy towards a market-based economy, and then really in the Great Depression, which the Great Depression made it very clear that, you know, however much you saved, if your bank was wiped out, then you were poor. It didn't matter how responsible you were. It didn't matter how skilled you were if unemployment's 20 or 30%. And so I think understanding that individuals or small groups of individuals and communities can't handle the real risks and problems of a, you know, modern capitalist economy, which promises huge rewards and huge growth, but makes any individual much riskier and much, you know, much more at risk of poverty. You know, that's, we know how to solve those things. Governments do it, and it's a question of whether or not we're going to do it more.
Well, a good note to end on as we celebrate Social Security's 80th birthday. Mike Konzel, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and a contributor to both The Nation magazine and Dissent, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network. We'll be back next week, Thursday at 4, also available on iTunes as a podcast, or you can listen online at weactradio.com. Special thanks to our executive producers, Alyssa Peterson and the one and only Greg Kaufman, CAP's amazing poverty and press teams.
And as always, DC's own Chris Stiles Bacon gets the last word. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?